Well, welcome to this podcast on the subject of transparency and multi-stakeholder governance, which is a very niche and very specific kind of transparency, a very unusual and I think emerging form of governance. And it relates to how you deal with a complex set of problems that may be transnational and which may involve a range of powerful actors, some of them state actors, some of them non-state actors. So that's the framing of our issue. And I'm very grateful to be joined by Evelyn Hernandez and John Hawkins, two old friends and colleagues from the Construction Sector Transparency Initiative, better known as COST, which has been going for more than 10 years now. And I've been involved in this wonderful initiative on and off during that time as an advisor on issues of governance and indeed on multi-stakeholder process. So welcome to you both, John and Evelyn. I want to first ask you both to introduce yourself and just tell us, how did you end up working for COST? Evelyn, perhaps you'd go first. You originate from Latin America and you were working with COST there, but you're now in Europe. Just tell us a little bit about your professional background and how and why you ended up with COST.
Thanks, Richard. Yes, I started to know COST in Honduras when I was an independent consultant. I was working for the World Bank and they invited me to apply for a consultancy to develop a disclosure system. And the system should comply with the COST infrastructure data standard. And I accepted the assignment and I started to work on that in 2013. And then a new government arrived, and the new government in Honduras in 2014 decided to join COST. And they proposed to use this platform to comply with the standard. And they invited me then to be the COST manager for the program. And I participated in that role. I did that role for 4 years, during 4 years. And then I moved to France for personal reasons. And I started to work directly with the COST International Secretariat as a technical advisor. And then I was appointed as head of members and affiliate programs. And my role is to support our members, providing technical assistance and to do that with our regional managers in the different regions where we work.
Wonderful. Thank you, Evelyn. And as you'll gather from that, people listening, this is a kind of members-only club, COST. You have to apply to join as a country. And as you heard, Evelyn is majorly responsible for managing that process and managing the membership. We'll come back to that. John, welcome. You work for an organization called Engineers Against Poverty. I don't think you're an engineer yourself, but tell us a little bit about how you ended up there and what Engineers Against Poverty do and their role in the COST Secretariat.
Thank you, Richard. And yes, quite right, I'm not an engineer. I'm a social scientist, a background in public policy, and I, for many years, so I've been working around Korea, the public policy side of infrastructure now for 20 years. And starting at the Institution of Civil Engineers, which is a professional engineers body in based in the UK, looking really at procurement policy, contract policy. And I was asked, because of my background, to be involved in the COST pilot when it started in 2008. When the UK Department for International Development thought that they could, were looking to really test the whole idea of multi-stakeholder working in various sectors, including infrastructure. So I was involved in a three-year pilot. I was also responsible for testing the approach that we'll be talking about in the UK, as well as kind of providing policy and technical support during the three-year pilot in eight countries. And then finally joining Engineers Against Poverty, who are responsible, who were asked by the World Bank to turn the pilot into a global program and relaunch it in 2012. And now I'm the program director, really looking at the strategic direction of COSS as an organisation. So COSS is a UK charity with its own independent board of trustees. It has a similar kind of legal status as Engineers Against Poverty. EAP has been around for a little more than 20 years as a UK charity, and really was set up to look at this kind of relationship between engineering, infrastructure, and international development, and looking back 20 years, and how really infrastructure is so critical to what were then the Millennium Development Goals and now the Social Development Goals.
Yes, and that kind of place in the Sustainable Development Goals is important in so many ways. The volume of money that will be invested in infrastructure is being invested in infrastructure. The importance of recalibrating infrastructure development to be climate resilient. And of course, in my continent, where South Africa, the University of Cape Town is based, the infrastructure development journey is absolutely critical to economic development and to social goals. Of course, we know that when large amounts of money are involved and complex public projects such as these, corruption often is the companion across the world. How important is that element of combating corruption? How important is that to the whole purpose of cost and to its theory of change, John?
It's very important. I think often this conversation around corruption, as you know, can be very difficult in many countries. So we often, how we frame corruption really is depends on the context and where we're working. And where do the government's challenges around infrastructure delivery lie? We are aware of, you know, I think most people are aware of the high kind of budget increases around and cost increases around infrastructure, and often the long gestation periods in terms of delivering infrastructure, and the waste that occurs through that. So, but really, through our approach of trying to open up infrastructure to greater scrutiny, we believe we can improve really how infrastructure delivered, those key kind of practices that are utilized, and really inhibit potential, deter corruption where it exists, you know, amongst government officials, but also private sector players.
And John, thank you. Just bring this back to transparency and information disclosure. What is the relationship between transparency and the disclosure of key parts of the information value chain, if I can use that expression, and this sort of accountability and integrity in public procurement that you set as a goal for cost?
One of the key things in terms of growing transparency and open data was that over a number of years there have been a lot of work done around kind of narrowly defined public procurement around tenders and contracts awards and making those more open to public scrutiny. What COSS looked at was, well, really there are so, because infrastructure has such a long journey in terms of from its kind of inception, where you're just selecting projects to through the periods of development and design and feasibility studies, right through construction and delivery. We wanted to open up all of those kind of that cycle, those different stages. So we really try to encourage governments to use what we call either the COSS infrastructure data standard or the open contracting infrastructure data standard, so that information is disclosed right through that project cycle. Really an arming civil society, the media, with that kind of critical information, because civil society and media have found it very difficult historically to obtain that information.
Yes.
But transparency is not an end in itself for us. We can't just disclose data, and we've got several countries which are disclosed, like Honduras that Evan will talk about, Ukraine being another example, Guatemala, where data is being disclosed at scale on sophisticated platforms. But we don't just want it sitting there. It needs to be used. So one of the key functions that COSS and our partners in country have been is thinking through what are the kind of mechanisms within that particular context, within those kind of within that political economy that can use the space that's available to engage citizens, journalists, to use that data to ask the right questions.
Go ahead. I was going to interrupt you, but
yeah, no. And if you remember, we're going right back to when we finished a pilot more than a decade ago. We were in Addis Ababa, in Ethiopia, where we were really testing this out, so to think through, well, what does accountability look like? And we brought together some nervous journalists with some even more nervous officials from the Roads Authority, one of the other two agencies. And we facilitated a workshop and where nothing was being said. And then suddenly there was this kind of marvelous buzz in the room by the end of before lunch.
Right. John, you'd hired me to facilitate that workshop, and it went from being what I thought was going to be one of the worst days of my professional career, when nobody was speaking, and I just couldn't light the fire in the room, to the point, as you just describe it, where at lunchtime, suddenly people were having conversations from different parts of society in Ethiopia, which is quite a closed society, and in many ways, democratic space is quite guarded there and carefully managed. And people were asking questions of people in government and the engineers in government and the professional people working for government. And the magical moment was when those people started almost enjoying the opportunity to explain themselves to journalists and civil society. And there one could see the magic of a very simple thing where one human being asks another one a well-informed question and the professional gets a chance to justify his or her position. So that was it in real life, if you like. And Evelyn, turning to you, you've worked at the front line of cost, if I can put it that way, for many years. For you, what does this information disclosure achieve? How does it then convert itself into impact and results and a change of practice or a change in the way a project, a big procurement infrastructure project, develops?
Yes, Richard, I think for our members, talking about Honduras initially, but then using different examples, I can explain that for our members it's important, and for the governments especially, to use a standard that has been recognized internationally to disclose data. And as John mentioned, we use the standard to disclose data and during the different phases in a project, from the identification to completion. And by using that standard, we ensure that key data points are going to be in the public domain. And people can use that data to analyze, to monitor what is happening in their communities or according to their own interests. And besides that, I think one important element is that we ensure that this disclosure is happening not just when the program is functioning, but when the program eventually will end. We would like to provide a value added where we work. And for doing that, we promote the establishment or the strengthening of legal mandates to disclose data. And we do that also using different tools that we have in place. We have some disclosure platforms that have been developed that they are very complete, very comprehensive. They have been designed having the public in mind. So now we have an open source code available for our members. So we don't develop every time a new tool. We can do it if we want, but we would like to facilitate this process so we can start the disclosure of data in a new member very fast when we provide this type of tools and support to our members. And it's not just disclosing data that is important. This is like the offering side, but we need also to train stakeholders from the private sector and civil society to use that data. Transparency is not just to disclose information, but helping people to understand that information, to access to it and to use it for their own purposes. So we do both the demand side also. We work not just with the media, but with the citizens and in communities, so they can understand what is affecting their lives, like the construction of the school or the construction of a water system supply in their community, so they can monitor and use data to monitor and ask the right questions.
That's very interesting, Evan. I mean, I think you make a couple of very important points here. The first one is that, and you use the language of supply and demand, which I think applies to all spheres of transparency work, that you need to have both strong demand and strong supply, and the two need to kind of meet. And cultivating both sides is critical to having a good transparency regime. And when it comes to infrastructure, often the information is highly technical, and ordinary citizens or communities, community groups won't really be interested in it or won't know how to engage with it. But if you tell them, well, actually, this is the information that will determine whether the roof over their children's head at school will fall down or not, mm-hmm. then, of course, people get very interested. Am I right?
Yes, exactly. And we also contribute to that analysis of technical data, and we try to convert that data into understandable messages for people to follow up. And we do a validation process, and we call that process assurance. But at the end, this is the analysis of data. And we, based on that, we can recommend to the government and to the different stakeholders participating in the sector to improve and to ensure quality. As you mentioned, Richard, it's important, but just not the quality of the infrastructure, but the contract management in order to cost to ensure cost savings or that we are on time in delivering infrastructure.
Yes.
And yes. And that we really provide these recommendations based on what the data is telling us. And this is official data. So we have the evidence to provide these constructive recommendations to the government.
I get you. And that's in an age of fake news. That's tremendously important. This is data that's official, and then it's validated through your assurance process. So it's very hard then for people to say, I'm not accepting this, or I'm going to ignore this. It adds a great deal of weight to the disclosure process. And it seems to me, John, coming back to you, it makes the link with accountability that much tighter. And your results over 10 years now with COST show this, that presented with evidence of what's gone wrong, overspends, or corruption or misallocations, etc., various elements of diagnosis that data revelations can show, that has resulted in direct savings and remedial action being taken. And you can now point to millions of dollars being saved in many countries.
Absolutely. I mean, we've seen, you know, savings of well over $400 million in Thailand, which they really do put down to the deterrent effect of greater transparency and scrutiny, you know, lower with companies submitting lower bid prices, understanding that the rules of the game have changed in the way tenders are now being managed. We've seen, you know, cost savings after that workshop we had in Ethiopia, really, it was the first example of this, where there was a road project where we saved just around $3 or $4 million. And I think one of the crucial things around this is the multi-stakeholder approach, bringing together government, civil society, and the private sector, and a safe space for them to have a kind of insider relationship with each other, to have informal conversations that allows them to have a discussion out of the public spotlight around the issues that Evan was talking about. And civil society can lean on those officials to say, hey, look, some things need to happen here, some changes need to happen. So I think Uganda's been a fascinating example of where this has happened in a country where you've got limited space of civil society and you know, a political economy that is fairly closed, and, you know, with elections very much managed, and where, you know, we have seen in communities kind of improvements to the roads that have improved the health and safety, reduced the number of accidents, and can issue drainage ditches have been correctly designed, particularly in areas of flooding. So you're beginning to bridge the macro issues of things like climate change, where, you know, where we've got extreme weather events with the remedial actions that have been taking place to improve the services and the provisions of local communities.
And John, I mean, I meant to make this point earlier. An important point we shouldn't lose sight of is that this information disclosure regime that your initiative, this global initiative, run through these multi-stakeholder processes you just described, the disclosure is made on the basis of voluntary standards. It's a voluntary disclosure regime, unless, of course, as Evelyn described, you persuade the member country to adopt a statutory regime that then codifies the approach.
Absolutely. This is completely voluntary. So we've had, at the moment, we have 19 governments either at a national or subnational level. So we're working with large states like Jalisco in Mexico and large cities like Bogota in Colombia, as well as countries such as we mentioned, Ethiopia, Uganda, Ukraine, Thailand, are committed. They sign up to these voluntary arrangements. They do it through because they believe it adds value to their reform efforts. And they commit to working with civil society and the private sector, as well as these voluntary disclosure standards. And we're there to really make sure, to monitor that they uphold those commitments and make sure that they deliver on what they agree to. And it has meant that some governments fail to do this, and they have, one or two have left the organisation because they've not been able to meet the commitments they agree to.
They've not walked the talk.
Exactly.
That's very important for maintaining that international standard and the integrity of cost and the principles that underpin it. John, you've described the multi-stakeholder process and the upside of it. It can't all be so easy. I know from my own experience, these things are very challenging to run. There's a sweet spot one can get to if you align all the forces, and we'll come to that. But Evelyn, from your experience on the front line, what are the biggest challenges of running an effective multi-stakeholder process? What are the real obstacles?
I think one of the main challenges is to ensure that we have the right people around the table. Mm. That is really difficult to identify the key players, but the key players that will be interested on working with others and based on the different interests that they have and try to look for one common goal that will be transparency and accountability, and to ensure that the individuals that represent the stakeholders, the key stakeholders, are the right people too. And also to have a balance of equal representation or in the decision-making process. And we need to make sure that even if the governments are they do this in a volunteer process, they will invite not just the friends to the table, but people that is really representing the interest of a sector like the private sector or civil society that is working promoting transparency and accountability. And sometimes we don't have the rules very clear in all of our members, and these challenges, we need to clarify the rules, and once we have the right people to have the rules in place and discuss how these people will be appointed and removed, and not just the individuals, but also the organizations and institutions, in order to have this balance and to ensure that the openness of the multi-stakeholder group and to ensure the dialogue and to ensure also that the values of cost will be implemented and the multi-stakeholder group will guide strategically the program. And they will use the best skills and experiences and knowledge of all the individuals and the organizations that they represent.
Evelyn, that's a wonderfully short but very comprehensive description of kind of the challenges and the kind of key ingredients. And it seems to me, from a sort of governance theoretical perspective, that what one's searching for is legitimacy. That the multi-stakeholder process, to be effective and to be trusted by the outside world, and to have heft to navigate that political economy, difficult as it often is, as John described, it needs to be sufficiently legitimate. And that, as you say, you need to have the right people there, needs to be sufficiently open, it has to have clear rules, and so on. And I suppose it needs to deal with, and you and I and John have encountered this in a couple of countries, it needs to deal with the rogue representative, the rogue stakeholder who kind of has wiggled his way into the process, but then actually isn't playing with the rules and is blocking things. How you remove that rogue stakeholder is one of the big challenges, isn't it?
Yes, we have to deal with this in different programs. I can tell you about Honduras, and we have a very it was not the organization, but it was the individual that was blocking a discussion around a finding in the assurance process, and the government itself realized that he was the wrong person. And they decided to remove. So it was really easy because the government realized that he was blocking the dialogue around a very important aspect of a project, because he was working on that project specifically, and he wanted to change the findings that were based on evidence. So the government was really keen and had the willingness to change this individual. But in other cases, we have some people that they are not. We had a case in Uganda that we have a representative from the government, and he resigned to his position, and he was not a official anymore, but still he wanted to be at the multi-stakeholder group because he has his own personal interest, but he was not representing a group actually. So it took a while to find a way, because the rules were not very clear on that, on how to remove the individuals. But at the end, we found the way, asking him to resign because he was not representing the government anymore at that time.
And Evelyn, it's clear that the shape and size of the particular multi-stakeholder process can vary from country to country and can be quite contextually specific. I remember that in the early days of COST in the Philippines, I think it was, the MSP started with just three members, one for business, one for government, and one from civil society. Now, in South Africa, that just wouldn't be trusted. If you told society and the media that the thing was going to be run with just three people, one from each sector, no one would trust that. But in the Philippines, it worked. So it does seem to be very contextually specific. But is there a danger of kind of elite capture that ironically, given that this is concerned with transparency, that a potentially quite powerful body could go underground and forget that it is should have a working relationship, a real conversational relationship with the broader bits of society and government that the individuals are there to represent?
Yes, exactly. And this is difficult. That's why we recommend to do at the beginning of a program a scoping study. We need to identify independently the key players and the potential MSG members. And I don't think three are representative of each one of the sectors. But the experience has tell us that around 10 or 12 organizations is a good number. And this is based on the experience. We have, in some cases, 40 members, like in Thailand, a formal MSG, but yes, they just meet twice a year, and they have opted to have a working committee to deal with the day-to-day. And they have meetings every month or every quarter or so. And in other cases, we have in Guatemala, the government is, I think they have less representatives than civil society and the private sector. And it's different in other, in other programs, we have more representation from the government. Like in Uganda, they are proposing to change the structure of the MSG and they have more representatives. But now the challenge is to find a way of the decision-making process should be like have the same number of votes, let's say, in that case. So, yes. And in other cases, the balance is between the individuals. And we also look for gender representation and balance. And some of the programs, like in Afghanistan, that we had one, the gender representation was a very big challenge. At the end, we could appoint a woman in the MSG, in that group, but it's a challenge to find a diversity of individuals and also the composition of the MSG. It depends on the context.
Yes. Well, Evelyn, thank you for sharing that real life experience. It seems that one of the big advantages of this kind of governance is its flexibility. It can form itself and craft itself in a shape that suits the context and matches the kind of contextual political economy and so on, and yet also needs enough formality in the rules of the game that people can understand what their responsibilities are and that people outside of the process can trust it. So we're out of time, alas, but that was a fascinating conversation, and we've packed into half an hour really a lot of information and analysis, and I'm very grateful to both you, John Hawkins, and you, Evelyn Hernandez, two of the leading figures in this extraordinary global club of nations that is working to bring real transparency and accountability to the infrastructure's development space. So thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
Thank you for the invite, Richard.